In September 1973, at the beginning of my final semester as a university undergraduate student, I enrolled in a history course on the Renaissance. The professor was Dr. Edward Panosian. And including the two required freshman-level courses on the history of civilization, it was my fourth semester to sit under his instruction. During that course, Dr. Panosian, in his distinct style, suggested periodically potential examination questions. And he recommended that the students who were wise should keep a separate list of those potential questions and to use those questions as a study guide to prepare for examinations. By that final semester of my undergraduate career, it was apparent to me that one of the secrets to success in education was to discover what the teacher wanted and to give what the teacher wanted to him or to her. It's probably still good advice for students, even if we are now living well into the 21st century. At the time of our mid-semester examination that fall, it proved to be the case that at least some of the questions from the list I was keeping did appear on the examination. So in preparation for the final examination in January 1974, and yes, in those dark days, the semester didn't end until after the Christmas holidays, I went over that list again and developed ways in which to answer the questions that could have appeared on the exam. Now, when the exam day arrived, Dr. Panosian entered the classroom and, after leading in prayer, went to the chalkboard. That sounds a little strange today, I realize. It was 43 years ago this month that this happened, and rather surprisingly, I suppose, there were no portable computers, smartphones, tablet computers, or digital projectors. So he went to the chalkboard, and he wrote on that chalkboard, yes, with a piece of chalk, a very brief question that formed our entire examination. It was, why Italy? Why Italy? Now, it just so happened that that was one of the questions on my list. And I had thought a lot about that question, and for one of the few times in my career as a student, I felt completely at ease in dealing with that question. Why did the Renaissance begin in Italy, is what he was asking, of all places. The exam period was 80 minutes in length, yeah, an hour and 20 minutes it was. And most of the students, myself included, used nearly all of that time to write page after page in answering that question. Now, those examinations were comprehensive and forced us to use the material we had learned in the course to organize an appropriate answer. There were no true-false questions, no multiple-guess questions, no fill-in-the-blank questions, just that question. It was a rare experience, at least it was for me, in which students left the exam room feeling that they knew more than they did when they entered it. That's not usually how you feel after an exam. This evening, we're going to begin a year-long series of messages on the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. Now, those who have been in this church over the years, nearly 31 years now of its history, will have to admit that if there's anything that I have tried to emphasize, it is the ongoing importance of the work of God that we call the Protestant Reformation. On that final day of October, 500 years ago, this year, there was no inkling, I think we can say, in the mind of Dr. Martin Luther, that his journey from his dwelling place to the Castle Church in Wittenberg to post a series of propositions or theses for debate within the university faculty could unleash a movement of such scope that it would alter the history of the world's development. But God's purposes that operate through the details of human activity often emerge when least expected. The blows of Luther's small hammer that fixed that list of Latin propositions to the church door. And so, to anyone reading it who wasn't a Latin scholar, they would have been without a clue as to what was said. But those blows echoed and re-echoed across the European continent in such a way that they unleashed a crescendo of such power that we, living five centuries afterward, continue to enjoy its effects. I was reading not long ago that a survey of historians revealed that they believed that the man of the second millennium was Martin Luther. I've also been reading that there have been efforts recently in Roman Catholic circles to try to rehabilitate Luther, to make him appear not so bad. We passed a resolution in the American Council Convention last fall dealing with that very subject, and the process has been continuing. Just within the last week or two, the Vatican released a postage stamp that has on it the image of Martin Luther as part of the Vatican's commemoration of the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. The great difficulty is, of course, that the Roman Church excommunicated Martin Luther almost 500 years ago, and therefore, by their teaching, he is in hell and will never get out of it. So how they're going to go about the process of walking that back and reconstructing Luther, I don't know. But I think that the process is underway that may lead ultimately to Luther being proclaimed as a saint of the church. Well, to begin our series, we want to use the old journalistic devices that many students have often heard in classes on English composition or on other forms of writing. Reporters learn that they are to ask questions. They want to know what kind of an article to write. They're to ask questions regarding any event or any idea or any person. And those questions are: what, how, who, when, where, and why? Well, we're going to use at least some of those questions in this series, but in a different order to provide some structure to what we're doing. This evening, we're going to vary the structure and the substance of Dr. Panosian's exam question from more than four decades ago, and ask the question in this way: The Reformation, why? The Reformation, why? Now, this congregation has benefited in prior decades from the ministry of Dr. Panosian in his retirement years, when he uses his knowledge of history and his ability in drama to portray historical characters in the first person. It's been a long time since he was here to do any of that, but you may recall that more than 20 years ago now, he came to Phoenix when we were still meeting in the school building. And he presented at that time three characters, and then he came again 2 years afterward in our first meetings at Rose Garden Lane, and he presented three other characters. One of the characters he presented the first time he came was Martin Luther. And one of the striking aspects of that presentation is that Luther was doing his best simply to carry out his responsibilities as a professor of law and theology. That there was no thought in Luther's mind that he was going to be the one to remake the Western world. After all, in Luther's day, he was born 9 years before Columbus discovered America. So in Luther's day, most people barely knew anything about what lay beyond the ocean to the west. And when Luther was born, there would have been many people who were convinced that the only thing that lay to the west was the edge of the earth, and if you went far enough, you would fall off the edge. But Luther, in his study, in connection with his responsibilities, came under the power of the Bible, under the power of the Scriptures. That was one of his areas of teaching at the university. The university students in the early 16th century were among those who were awakening to a vast trove of knowledge that was undoing the ignorance, relatively speaking, of the Middle Ages. Luther became aware that in the words of our text this evening in 2 John 7 through 11, there were many deceivers in the world. Luther believed in a very much of a personal devil. And he knew that there were many deceivers in the world, and that some of those deceivers appeared in the form of church clerics. And as he came to understand that reality, he confronted the efforts of John Tetzel to peddle papal indulgences as a fundraising effort for the completion of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, which was the seat of papal power and prestige. Now, the idea that indulgences amounted to an attack on the gospel itself seized more and more of Luther's attention. And he determined to summon others to recognize the way in which the doctrine of indulgences undermined the doctrine of Christ. Now, Martin Luther was only a man, and just one man at that. But he had come to know what the Scriptures taught regarding salvation. And he knew that what Pope Leo X and his emissary Tetzel were teaching was not according to the Scriptures. And it wasn't long before Luther realized that his effort to draw his colleagues into what he envisioned as an academic debate within the walls of the university was mushrooming outward into a movement that was stirring the slumbering souls of Germans and others concerning their peril before God. Why did the Reformation happen when it did? Well, there are four parts to that answer that we want to consider at least in part this evening. First of all, the value of gospel liberty. The Reformation, why? The value of gospel liberty. We read in 2 John of the doctrine of Christ, and as Luther came to understand it more and more, he realized that it was the only liberating doctrine that existed. Luther thought a lot about a statement that Paul wrote to the Galatians. And let's turn back to the Epistle to the Galatians and to chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5. Luther was employed in lecturing on the Galatians when a lot of these ideas began to take shape in his mind. Galatians 5 and verse 1, the apostle wrote, "Stand fast therefore in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage." So he was concerned about this theme of the liberty wherewith Christ has made us free, and the warning not to go back to the bondage. And Luther came to understand that to surrender that liberty was to give up the source of comfort and confidence in the soul. He knew, as he also read in Romans chapter 1, that the gospel was the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes. So he knew that for people to be delivered from a system that taught they had to do acts of penance to gain the forgiveness of God was worth far more than any amount of money that was needed to build 100 versions of St. Peter. If they could get that in their heads, that liberty would be so valuable to them, they would never want to give it up. The Reformation then became the first freedom movement in the Western world, because the source of that freedom was not some political idea. It was the awareness that Christ sets people free from the curse of the law. So the life and the death of Christ, the God-man, became the heart of the Reformation's idea. The doctrine of Christ. And the Reformers became known as those who preached Christ. Luther said that he looked for Christ on every page of the Bible. People went to their deaths in the Reformation. And I'm not just talking about those who were prominent who went to their deaths and whose histories we have recorded for us, but many other people who were just ordinary people. There was nothing spectacular about them except that they were followers of Jesus Christ. And they went to their deaths, and some of them suffered horribly in prison because they would not yield such a precious commodity as their liberty in Jesus Christ. Not the liberty to be licentious, not the liberty to be ungodly, not the liberty to be carnal, but the liberty to follow after the truth of the gospel. The Reformation flourished then because of the value of gospel liberty. And that's a message that continues to resonate with us 500 years later. But there was something else that caused the Reformation to spread. And that's the second part of the answer, the violence of apostasy's enmity. The violence of apostasy's enmity. So the unyielding opposition of the papal hierarchy ensured that the Reformation would succeed. That was not what they thought, but it did ensure it. And it ensured that the Reformation would spread so far that the lands in the New World, of which most people had only a very hazy notion at that time, the lands in the New World would be populated by many people who came to know the truth. And though that went so, when they came to the New World, they carried with them the legacy of the Reformation. The treatment of the followers of the Protestant doctrine became the fuel then that spread the fire of the Reformation farther and farther. Arrests, imprisonments, sometimes in the most horrifying conditions, tortures. Oh, they devised all kinds of implements to torture people. I mean, you hear today people complain about techniques like waterboarding and so on. Nothing compared to what was done to Protestants in the Reformation period. Gruesome executions, being burned alive. All these things did not have the effect that the leaders of Rome supposed they would have. They thought it would be a means of intimidation. The people would not want to be exposed to those kinds of treatments. But it didn't have that effect because people had come to know what the truth was. Christ had become to them that with which they could not part, and they could not be deterred from believing on him and from believing the truth of the gospel. So it came to pass at the Diet of Augsburg in 1530, which was only 13 years after Luther put up his 95 Theses, various Lutheran princes, only 13 years, think of that, various Lutheran princes confronted the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, who had called the Diet together to insist that everybody return to the faith of the church. They confronted the emperor with the assertion they were ready to die before they would renounce the truths of the scriptures. So the intimidation factor didn't really have an effect on those who had come to understand the truth. Now that assertion that they made did not stop others from trying to stamp out the Reformation by the use of violence. During the 5 years of the reign of Queen Mary Tudor, that was from 1553 to 1558 in England, a period for which she is justly known as Bloody Mary, more than 300 people, some of them prominent, some of them ministers, but others who were not, more than 300 people lost their lives for refusing to recant, to say nothing of others who lost their lives in prison before they could ever be brought to execution. It was as though the devotees of false religion were thrashing about in the terror of their own devising. And their fury against the truth did nothing but to cause it to gain new adherents. The violence of apostasy's enmity was another reason for the Reformation. But now we come to the third reason, the voice of heaven's authority. The voice of heaven's authority. The success of the Reformation, of the Protestant Reformation as a movement, lay in the Bible. In fact, one of the five solas that were designed to emphasize the message of the Reformation was sola scriptura, the scriptures alone. The Bible alone, the religion of Protestants. The Bible then became the expression of the religion of the Protestants. They were not interested in hearing about the traditions of the saints or even of the church fathers. They were interested in what the scriptures had to say. So the traditions of the past that had previously overridden the scriptural teaching in many cases, those traditions yielded to the recovery of the voice of heaven. From the apostolic age, in the scriptures of truth, there was a movement to go back to the Bible. So the reformers sought to reassert or to recover, and I will emphasize again during this series, the reformers were not innovators. They didn't come up with something new. That was the charge that was laid against them. Oh, you brought some new doctrine. No, they didn't bring any new doctrine. They recovered what had been lost under centuries of tradition. They argued for the doctrine of the inspiration of the scriptures. They argued that the scriptures became the judge, the rule of faith and practice. They argued that only in the scriptures could anyone hear the voice of real authority. And when we think of the Reformation, we have to think of it in those terms. In the Bible, people heard what God said. This is what the Pope says. This is what the councils say. This is what the fathers say. And then they would place that against what the scriptures say. So it was that Luther, for example, at the Diet of Worms in 1521, when he was urged to recant, said, unless it could be proved to him from the scriptures alone that he had erred, he would not be bound by the findings of the popes or the councils, because he said they had often erred and contradicted each other. So unless it would be from the scriptures themselves that he would be proved wrong, he would not recant anything. And that was the spirit of the Reformation. They were listening to the voice of heaven's authority through the scriptures. And that leads me to the fourth reason for the Reformation, the visitation of divine ability. The visitation of divine ability. When I took Dr. Panosian's course in the Reformation, which I took about a year and a half before I took the course on the Renaissance, one of the things that struck me in a book we had to read, which is still to this day the standard biography of Martin Luther, by Roland Bainton, who was not necessarily sympathetic with Luther or with the religion of the Protestants. But what he pointed out in there was a statement that Dr. Panosian emphasized, and I've never forgotten, that the Reformation was preeminently a revival of religion. Now, there are historians who try to make it other things, economic development, political development, social development, so on. All of those factors were at play. But for Bainton, a secular historian, to emphasize in his biography of Luther that the Reformation was preeminently a revival of religion is an indication of the fact that it was the moving of God's Spirit in power on the souls of people that generated the Reformation. The Reformation, why? Because God's Spirit moved in power. And literally tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people felt the impact of that message. To them, it was something different. It was something new. But it was not just something that they hadn't heard before. It was something that had spiritual power. It was a message that the Spirit impressed upon people that this is the truth. This is how I can be saved. This is how I can know that my sins are forgiven. And this power of the Spirit of God produced the victory of godliness over the carnality of the false system of Romanism. And that was what set the Protestants apart. They didn't behave the way the Romanists did. Many of the priests were drunkards. And there was really no condemnation of how people had behaved as long as they had the proper indulgence or had done the prescribed penance. But in the Reformation, there was not only the calling to understand that people are saved by grace alone, through faith alone, in the merits of Christ alone, but that those who are so saved are saved unto good works, are saved to a life of obedience unto God, to living as those who have been redeemed by the blood. So this visitation of the Spirit's power produced a dramatic effect. It was an effect that no one could have anticipated. It came at a time when the world was in darkness, spiritually, intellectually, and in many other ways. But it was, nevertheless, a time when God moved. Now that gives me hope, because the world has always been marked by darkness spiritually. And the age in which we live certainly is marked by that, by the fascination with perversion. And now in this year, when Rome itself is trying to rehabilitate Luther, we need to remember something that I saw pointed out today. That here today, in the 500th anniversary year, Luther is still under the excommunication of the church. And so by the definition of the church, he's in hell. Now, they may followed the scheme of trying to have him declared not such a bad person after all. That seems to be the emphasis of Pope Francis. But the truth is that he led a movement that overthrew the old order and restored to people the truths that the apostles preached. Here is the doctrine that we must embrace again and never let go. We live in an age when we need to see the power of the Reformation let loose again. That is a great need. It was a mighty spiritual awakening. And all of the benefits that flowed from the Reformation, pale into insignificance when you consider that there were many people who had been born into the Roman Catholic Church, who found their liberation from the church and died in faith in Christ, knowing they would not be in purgatory, knowing that they would be in the presence of the Lord forevermore. May God give us grace then, as we consider this theme in this year, to find ourselves again embracing the truth that salvation is by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone.